Hi, and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and I'm joined by security practitioners who will introduce themselves. And today's icebreaker question was inspired by a study that said that people like the idea of privacy, but it's a little hard to really execute, especially when you're offered pizza in exchange for their friend's email address. So how many pizzas would you want before you think it's worth it to give up your friend's email's address?
I would take the possibility of a pizza. In preparation for this, I've actually signed Killian up to a number of pizza enthusiast lists. PizzaPizzaToGo.com, you know, MakingMeAPizza.com. There's a lot of them. There's more than you think.
Hi, this is Killian. Mike, I don't blame you. I mean, I sold you right up the river for, you know, just a plain cheese. You know. We're not even throwing in toppings.
This is Mike Thompson. I would definitely sell out my friend for a single pizza. This article made the parallel between an email address and a social security number, and I think that's a bit of a stretch. You can delete an email. I'll sell out my friend for free pizza easily, as long as it's a large pizza.
P-I-Z-Z-A, pizza, pizza all the way. Thanks, guys. So as always, our housekeeping announcement is if you're a regular listener and enjoy our show, please go to iTunes to rate and review the Inside Out Security Show, and we'll put you in the running for a deck of our InfoSec cards that's based on the Cards Against Humanity card game. To learn more, please visit veronis.com/review. So let's go to today's show. On this show, we have very different viewpoints when it comes to privacy and IoT devices, and I found that the FTC, they updated their guidance on COPPA, which is the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, and they said that the risk and harm of a company collecting and sharing children's information is very real. We've never really talked about this on our show, but a few years ago, there was a personalized learning company called In Bloom, where the parents, they rallied together because they didn't want this company collecting all sorts of information about their child, like test scores, special ed information, personality, and behavior. There is no proof of that company misusing the information, but a bunch of parents from all the various states, they said no to In Bloom, and then they eventually went out of business. And while most of the time parents are clueless about student data and privacy, in a survey, 94% of parents said that they want to be informed when their child's record was being shared so they know who it was being shared and why. And you guys say that the market isn't changing and parents aren't going to stop buying these toys and apps and whatnot, but my opinion is that this COPPA update tells us that IoT companies, at the very least, that they need to be careful with how privacy is being used and delivered to parents. And I want to hear your thoughts.
I think something that us as technical people sometimes, or maybe I should just speak for myself, sometimes things I have trouble with is when old legislation, old laws are kind of leveraged or abused, in my opinion, to try and control how we use technology, you know, using stuff that was written in the 30s to apply to the internet, right, to old Telephone Act stuff. However, I think this is pretty good. You know, I think, you know, parents are already cognizant of this type of stuff, of their children's privacy. So I think in this case, this is a really good opportunity for some existing legislation to kind of be leveraged to control what, you know, we've widely covered here as kind of a wild jungle of technology, all this Internet of Things devices. So I don't know. I think this is a good first step towards some decent regulation in this regard.
Mike, I'm going to go ahead and ask you to not have your kids come in the room. I'm still bugging your house with that Hello Barbie, so I don't want to get in trouble for that.
Literally, I went out to lunch today, and I went downstairs, and I asked my daughter, who's 6, hey, you want to go have lunch with me? And she's like, no, I'm busy. And she was busy trying to record herself with an iPad playing a game called Slime Ranchers on the Xbox that she could put on YouTube. And I haven't even told her about like streaming, like Twitch or anything like this. She's just like, no, I'm going to have a YouTube that does this. So that's her conception of what privacy is, you know, having as many people as possible watch her play Slime Ranchers.
In contrast to the US's view of privacy, let's talk about the way China is using facial recognition software in a way that I'm not sure it'll ever be used in such a public way in the US, because we say we're so worried about our privacy, some not so much. But what's happening in China is that they're using it everywhere in the workplace, at the ATM, unlocking a smartphone, and I think is really funny how they're using this technology to limit how much toilet paper someone can use within a particular time frame. And I think it makes total sense that the Chinese are using this, because it's in their culture to use a form of public shaming to deter people from breaking the law. And I remember this happening in the U.S. in a Chinese supermarket, where they made a person hold up a sign as a punishment when they stole something.
I think what's interesting is China is such a massive country with so many people, yet they're quick to adopt technology on this scale. A lot of times when we talk about adopting new technology or infrastructure improvements in the U.S., I feel like apologists like to say, "Oh, the U.S. is such a big country; you can't look at these high-tech Asian countries like South Korea and assume the U.S. can operate on that scale." But China's doing it. And my wife just got back from 3 weeks in China, and she was telling me all the things that are handled differently there. One of which being, payment is entirely mobile-based now. If you pull out your wallet, they kind of roll their eyes and groan at you. Everything's QR codes and, paying with mobile payments and WeChat. So I'm kind of impressed that they're able to do this, but imagine infrastructure management and resource management in a country of that size. They have to leverage every little bit of technology they can to do it effectively. So kudos to them.
Well, there's Metcalfe's law, which is that, a network is valuable the square of the number of people that are on it. They have more people. So I think there's also, if it improves things, 0.02%, then, they get a much more massive value out of it than maybe otherwise.
I think also part of it, too, is pretty interesting innovation they're doing. But you also have to think they have a different conception of privacy than we do, at least institutionally. I think it's much more common for them to kind of assume that they're being monitored a little bit more closely and under surveillance in a lot of cases, where, at least here in the U.S., we at least believe we have much more privacy than maybe we really do. But it's again, a cultural difference.
Do you think it's a cultural difference in terms of the perception of the reality? Because I'm not sure, if paying with WeChat is terribly different than if I pull out my credit card and buy a book. That's not a good example. Who buys books is physical books. How about, I buy an apple at the grocery store or something?
I don't think it's radically different. But what I thought was interesting is she said even high-end restaurants would have a QR code printed on the table. So there was never any interaction with the server, really, when it's time to pay your check. You just scan that QR code and you're on your way. So it's just kind of universally adopted at that level, where it's not only is it available to you, but it is the primary method for everybody. And while we're talking about privacy, Facebook already knows what my face looks like. They auto-tag me in photos. The government knows what my face looks like. They scan my face when I, go through customs at the airport. So I don't know. That bridge has already been crossed probably as well.
Well, Microsoft, they did this thing. I think you can take a picture of yourself and it'll tell you how old they think you are. Did you guys do that?
Turns out I'm really old, so.
Well, no, I never did that either. But even if you're one of the unlucky people that has a Kinect with your Xbox, it can sign you in with that as well, too. So it is out there. I just think that at least here we have some expectation that they're not doing it or they shouldn't. But as the mics have said, the bridge has been crossed already.
Okay, let's talk about something else that's a bit controversial in another country. There is a Canadian company that accused another company of taking their product and repackaging it and selling it online. And the company denied it, but they started doing business outside Canada and they never reappeared in court. So then the Canadian, they won by default. And they requested Google remove the other company's information from the index, and they did. And then it was later granted by the Supreme Court that Google needed to remove it globally. And then that's where Google pushed back and said it was limiting one's right to freedom of expression. But the Supreme Court said they need to remove it globally. And we've seen the contrast with how technology is used in China versus the US. And we've discussed in previous episodes about how GDPR will impact how organizations will do business. It'll be complicated to see which country's law will prevail when it comes to complicated rulings.
I am so conflicted all the time with this about how are we going to legislate these things. To me, it's less challenging on the criminal front. Like, I think there's some widely cross-country, you know, definitions of what's criminality. Like, no one wants to have fraudulent activity happen to them. No one wants to have that stuff. And to me, where this really crossed was a sort of civil slash business corporate type of law, which is, you know, much, much more common. And there's, you know, at every level of business, every day, there are arguments and lawsuits like this. And we talk a lot of times, like, I don't think it's the IT department's job to figure out all the legal ramifications of stuff within a company. I'm not sure it's these tech companies' job to figure out the legal ramifications of all of these things either. And I really worry that we're going to get into a situation where they're so burdened down by this stuff that they can't adequately function.
It's an interesting kind of a good contrast from last week's episode, or the one we just published, I guess, depending on when you're listening to this, but about how the GDPR is going to, in effect, apply pretty much globally at this point. But it's something that is, you know, was made and designed for EU countries, but, you know, the ramifications are global. In the exact same case that we're seeing here is that the lawsuit was taken up in Canada with a Canadian company, and the Canadian Supreme Court issued this. But now Google, you know, a US company, is voluntarily took down the search indexing for the Canadian version of Google, but they said it's not good enough. So as Mike said, which law prevails at this point? I mean, the internet is global and it's shared. So that causes a lot of conflicts. Again, we typically think of our nations as having physical borders, but the internet doesn't operate like that. So it could potentially put us in quite a bit of conflict with no easy solutions. I mean, does that mean that at all times, the most restrictive law applied anywhere in the world is going to become the default law? I think that might be very challenging for innovation for these businesses, or just maybe incredibly burdensome, as Mike had mentioned.
What I think is kind of also complicated is these companies' relationship to the internet as a whole. I mean, Google is an essential service for so many people now, and you know, I think of what Google does as a search engine. Their job's to index the internet. It's not their job to police what's on the internet. They're just indexing what's there and providing that information back to us. But that's oversimplified, right? They're a huge company. They're making tons of money off these internet services. They have to play by the laws as well. So it's a murky gray area, as you know, you guys have both said. But you know, it's weird to think about some of these huge corporations having such an essential part of really how our daily life works when it comes to the internet.
I guess I look at this as almost a vector of attack on the internet, in that this is one case, and it, obviously I'm not a lawyer, obviously, and you know, to look at it and you're like, oh, I'm very sympathetic to this. It seems like this company, they had their stuff ripped off. They shouldn't be penalized for that if someone leaves the country, and this is a good way that they can seek some. They aren't even trying to like sue these people out of existence. They're just saying like, we made this thing. We should get the credit for it if people search for it, which all seems incredibly legitimate. What I worry, though, is that when this gets spun out into, you know, my Etsy shop and I see someone else has made like earrings that look pretty similar to mine and I file an injunction against them. And, you know, I make a game and it happens to have the same, you know, mechanics because we both use the Unity game engine for this. And I put something out, or I wrote a book and you happen to use the same, you know, character structure because it happens to be three acts. And one of the characters is a wizard who's, you know, poor and orphaned in the beginning, that suddenly now there's literally millions of these lawsuits, because this is something that happens all the time. And I think it could just have some really bad effects. So,
Mike, if your book has words in it, I am definitely taking you to court.
Look, it has a lot of the same words other books have in it at the same time. And so I think I have the right to sue these people.
So we've talked about the potential privacy risks when it comes to children and the use of facial recognition software in China. and the complexities of the law because of our globalized economy. All to say that regardless of what country you're from and whatever values you hold dear, they're all on the line when it's at the mercy of security. And we saw some of the ways, the breakdown of our security rather quickly after April, when shadow brokers, they leaked a bunch of attack tools developed by the NSA. And when the ransomware outbreaks happened, you know, hospitals, schools, cities, police departments, all the institutions that we rely on, they have to defend themselves on their own. And there's a lot going on in our security world. And first, I want to talk about the latest ransomware attack this week, where it's being said that it wasn't financially motivated, but the intent was to destroy data. They encrypt the data, toss the key out, and you have no hopes of ever recovering it. Do you think we should be thinking about data differently than money? Because we often equate treating data like money, but the devastation of losing data, I feel, is a little different.
Well, at some level, you can trade these things for one another. And I think that's how most civil law works, that if, you know, if I come into your restaurant and I break up all the tables and chairs, like beyond anything criminal, you could say like, oh, there's a definite cost to get new tables and chairs for the restaurant. If I break up Killian's pizza oven, he can charge me for how much a new pizza oven to get installed in his apartment is. So I think there's some equivalency there. And, you know, a lot of times we see that in terms of remediation, that, oh, like big virus, it takes, you know, five IT people all week to update things and fix stuff. Well, that there's a real cost to that.
I mean, certainly there's a monetary cost to data. And we talk about it a lot as, you know, our job is to help protect that data. It is a huge, that's for most companies today, the data is their business. So it's probably more valuable than money. So I think what's unique about this attack is they're preying on that fear. You know, our data is valuable. I'm willing to pay the ransom to get that data back. That's where all my energy and focus is going as I'm responding to this apparent attack. And meanwhile, it's done all this other stuff in the background. It's really, its sole purpose was to wreak havoc. This guise of ransomware is a pretty convenient mask to wear, I suppose. It's a good disguise because everyone's focused on this right now. There's been so many high-profile breaks. I think it was pretty clever of them to just disguise it that way, and it sounds like this is probably going to be an ongoing trend when it comes to malware and attacks.
In a lot of ways, I feel like data is a lot more valuable than money. Money has a pretty direct, you know, value, you know, inflation, all that other stuff set aside. If you think, Mike, and actually both of you, going back to some of your examples, it's not just the upfront costs. It's very much compounded. So if you, you know, break my pizza oven or my tables in my restaurant, I have the upfront cost of replacing that particular whatever it is item. But then if you think about the lost revenue, the lost business, the time it's going to take, you know, for me to get my employees to clean up, the lost revenue from people coming in and buying pizzas in this example. I think in that case, data is very, very similar. You have the upfront cost of whatever it happens to be for paying the ransom, but then the time to recover, the man hours to restore the services, the time and money maybe to invest in PR to control brand damage. So in that case, an attack like this has much more compound damage in value in the data than I think we even give it credit for in a lot of cases.
It's so true. I think of emotional labor and childcare and a lot of caring that women do. That's often, you know, unpaid work, but it's valuable. And how do you quantify that? I know we like to equate it with money, but there's a sixth sense, a feeling about the data that, like, if, like, I wrote an origami book a long time ago. And if I had lost the patterns to my designs, I mean, it took me like a day to do one pattern. Like, if I lost that entire day's worth of work, like, oh my God, I would have been so upset if that had happened. And then fine, you have to do it again, but there's an intellect cost there. And you can say, oh, maybe your next idea will be better. But I feel like it'd be interesting if there was some kind of research.
I think what you're describing is there's some things that are unrecoverable that, you know, the time and your creativity and things. And I don't know if there's ever a good monetary compensation for that. I wanted to roll back to something else that, Mike said, which is we're talking a lot about this NotPetya attack. And is it ransomware? Is it an attack pretending to be ransomware? And no one really knows. I mentioned Metcalfe's Law earlier. The other thing, I don't know if you've heard of Hanlon's Razor, which is never attribute to malice what can be explained by stupidity. And, you know, if you look at sort of the makeup of this attack and what's in it, it's a lot. It looks like a lot of other ransomwares. And it's so hard to tell, like, is this something where someone just took other bits of more sophisticated ransomwares and glued them together a little bit and then said, like, oh, we can try this thing? Or is it, you know, I guess I'm just, there's a narrative that develops around all of these things, and it's impossible. Like, literally, I think it is just impossible to know exactly like where this stuff comes from and what's true. And I find that very frustrating, both in that we'll never know, and also all the speculation around it, you know, and in a lot of cases, it doesn't matter. I mean, if you're Maersk and your, you know, shipping hubs are down all over the world because you've been infected by this, does it matter if someone maliciously targeted you versus, you know, that it was an accident? Like, I don't know.
To bring a little levity to this, when Cindy said Sixth Sense, my first thought was Bruce Willis. Let's tie this back to Die Hard here. This is almost like a reverse Die Hard. Think about it. I won't explain it. I think our listeners will get what I'm saying here.
Yeah, Die Hard 4, where he goes to Russia and they fight computer viruses. Yeah.
So and if we see a new ransomware outbreak that's called Reverse Die Hard, we know who's responsible.
Not Reverse Die Hard is what it's going to be called. It's going to be
that's
great.
That's it.
Sorry. Okay, so not killing cat.
But I mean, think about it. You know, the premise of the first movie, at least, and I guess I will explain it, was that, you know, they were there under the cover of a hostage situation, but they were really there to steal money. This is the exact opposite of that. You know, this is the cover of you know, theft, basically, but they're there to, well, cause damage or be quote unquote terrorists.
Okay, so my last question of the day, I feel like it ties everything back together. There's an article about how our connected systems, everything's connected, internet could kill us. And then meanwhile, the UK says they're prepared to use airstrikes to send in troops as retaliation against future cyber attacks. What do you think the biggest security threat is right now?
That probably depends on what country you live in. For us, I think cybersecurity is pretty prominent. I mean, obviously there's a lot of fear of, you know, election tampering right now that's in the news here in the United States. So I think most people would say cyber attacks are, you know, critical for the safety of our nation as we know it, but that people in Syria probably would not have the same assessment. But the thing that stuck out to me about that that article about all the systems being interconnected, you know, I've read many articles over the years, these worst case scenarios, what could go wrong, how could we pull down the power grid with a cyber attack or things like that. But the one that I had never really considered was talking about how much food is in a city at any given time. And they said the average city has about 3 days worth of food on the shelves at any given time because they're receiving regular shipments and all that stuff is coordinated and, you know, enabled by the internet. So should the internet go down for a municipality, there might be a food shortage very, very, very quickly, especially because people will probably, you know, rush to the stores like a you know, a blizzard's coming. They got to get all the bread and milk. So that was something I hadn't really considered before. And the British response of we're willing to send in troops in retaliation, that article was a little war hawkish to me. It looked like, you know, some generals trying to drum up some funding for their armies. However, I think that's valid as well. You know, if it was truly a massive scale cyber attack, that is the easiest way to harm our country without having to send troops across the border. So, you know, in certain extent, that might be a valid response.
Well, it doesn't even have to be like that dramatic, I think, to have a dramatic response. And I think that's where it gets weird. Like we started earlier talking about China and how most of their transactions are done online, that if that went away, how do they pay for things? So I had the experience today at lunch, my card, the credit card, like it's just the magnetic strip is worn off. So it wasn't reading, like, and I was trying to buy this little tablet at Best Buy and they have no means of actually punching in the numbers now. Because I'm assuming there were fraudulent things where people punched in the wrong numbers or, you know, they don't trust the cashiers. so that you can only swipe. So I had no way to buy this stupid little tablet. And you can imagine, well, if I couldn't do that and then all the systems were down and there's no way to get cash, like how would I actually purchase things? You know, how would you even buy food with the grocery store? And it's just, I think it, a lot of this is much more fragile than we think.
So Mike was about 5 minutes from living on the streets, it sounds like.
I was like, I can't get any Wi-Fi, please, just a drop of Wi-Fi, 3 packets. Any packet makes a difference.
Killian, do you have thoughts?
I have a lot of thoughts. I'm just going to keep,
can you spare a packet, stockpiling
my canned goods.
Canned Wi-Fi. One can of Wi-Fi, and I'll make it through to the end of the week.
Come on, Spaceballs reference, canned air. I had to get one more reference in today.
What's going on in Mike's corner? Do you have a tool this week?
You know what? I completely forgot about having a tool this week. I was so shook by not being able to use my credit card at lunch.
Maybe you can develop a tool for the Best Buy people to... Don't you have a chip in your card?
No, we don't have chips yet.
Mike can develop what's called a keyboard with keys on it that have numbers that they can punch in other numbers?
Well, I think it really was like, she's like, we aren't allowed to type those in anymore. I assume that's because they were doing bad things and they can't trust their employees.
You don't have Android Pay or Apple Pay?
No, because I apparently suck.
Did you ride there on a dinosaur or?
Maybe. I'm not saying no. I'm not saying yes. I mean, dinosaurs might have been involved.
He skitched behind one on a skateboard.
Yeah.
There are blow up ones that we can get on Amazon that we really like.
It's for decoration. That'll be the new form of currency after all the credit cards go down. Inflatable dinosaurs.
How are you going to buy anything on Amazon once the credit cards go?
They have it. I assume Amazon will be the only thing left working.
Thanks to Mike Buckby, Killian Engler, Mike Thompson, and all our listeners for joining us today. If you want to follow us on Twitter to find some of the stories we're discussing, you can find us at infosec_podcast. Thanks, and we'll meet up again next week. Bye, guys.
Take care.
Bye. Thanks, everyone. Bye, Cindy.